And now, live from Jerusalem, you're listening to Israel Inspired Radio. Here are your hosts, Rabbis Ari Abramowitz and Jeremy Gimpel.
Shalom, and you are listening to Israel Inspired on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com. Ari Abramowitz here, and we are doing an interview on this program that is very exciting to me. And I'll tell you, being in Jerusalem, you know, Jerusalem is the spiritual capital of the world, the capital of seekers, those with questions that are trying to find their way to an authentic service of God for them. So in some people, it just manifests in all sorts of different ways. The person who we're interviewing now is a story that I heard third person, and I was so inspired by it. I said, we got to get this guy on the network. And as you know, we haven't been doing that many interviews on our show. It's usually just Jeremy and I talking and ranting, but I had to get him on the program. He's someone who's converted to Judaism, but I want to make something clear that in Torah Judaism, we do not encourage converts or conversion, from the simple reason that we don't believe that everyone is supposed to be a Jew. It says, Hager Shemit Gayer, the convert who converts. It doesn't say the non-Jew who converts, but the convert who converts, because we believe that if they have a Jewish soul and they bring that in their journey into manifestation, they become a Jew, they're simply realizing who they really are. We dissuade converts because we don't think that everyone is supposed to be a convert. Naomi sent away Ruth three times trying to dissuade her. And that's what we do. We dissuade people, but those who fight and seek to overcome and really want to become a Jew, well, the journey is a very inspiring one. And this journey, the simple, the comprehensiveness of it, the breadth of it, was very inspiring to me. So let's get right to it. His name is Ben-Tzion Mandela. He's with me right now, and I intentionally didn't get into the nitty-gritty of his story because I wanted to experience it with all of you. So Ben-Tzion, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us your story. Where do you start?
I don't know where to start, but I'll just start. I come from a village that's around 450 kilometers from the capital of Nairobi, Kenya.
What's it called?
It's called Lugari.
Lugari.
Yeah. My family, basically, and I, my parents, they're peasants. You know, they're farmers. That's all we do to earn a living. Grew up in a lot of basically punishing poverty, as I like defining it. Not easy at all. But you know, Hashem always has a plan, as I usually say. You know, we all have a path. You know, He gives us choices. He gives us ways. He probably opens our eyes, and at times we can choose to like follow what we see. You know, that's part of the divine that's usually in the hearts of every man. You know, it actually stars us. You know, it stars us. So at times we follow that spark to where it's going to take us.
And that spark, it speaks to everybody. It's not just Jews. That
absolutely.
Is wherever they are, if you're a human being created in the image of God, that spark is within you. And the simple challenge is just to take it or leave it, and it takes courage, and you had that courage. Yeah. So go on, tell us.
And it's a spark that was also with me right there in Africa. You know, the history of Africa, it's a history of missionaries, it's a history of colonialism, people coming from different places, from the west of the developed world, so to speak, as they call it there. And they come there and, you know, they're trying to show people the way or the light. So you find people there who are used to a different culture, who grew up with a different religion, the traditional African religion. They believe probably if there's a huge mountain, the divine is there. So when you pray, you face towards that mountain. If there's a huge old tree there, you believe, well, probably that's where the divine is. And you pray facing that tree. So that's the traditional religion that we were accustomed to, or my parents, my great-grandparents were accustomed to. So
what would you call that religion? Does it have a name? Would you call it idolatry, or not saying it in a derogatory way.
Right.
I'm saying it in a, because I mean, I don't mean that in that derogatory way, because I just came back from, not just, but I went to Taiwan, and in front of the World Trade Center of Taiwan, they had this table set up with all this food and stuff that they were giving to the god of money. And I said, well, at least they recognize that there's a higher spiritual force as opposed to sometimes in the West where they worship the money itself. You know, like there's something to idolatry. Abraham himself was an idolater before he came to see the one true God. So I don't mean it in a derogatory way, but I'm asking, would you call that idolatry? Do you feel like you were raised in a world of idolatry and paganism?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's where I was raised. It's a world of idolatry and paganism. I mean, I'm talking now as a Jew. You know, when you're there, you don't see it that way. You know, when you're in that part of the world, the way I was growing up, even before now, I started venturing and I started searching real hard. I didn't see it that way. But that's what it is.
Even as a child, you were a God searcher.
I was searching. I was really searching deep down. I mean, I felt there's definitely something. There should be something.
This is such a great story. I just want to cherish every moment and not skip to the end. If you don't mind, if I could just ask you some questions about that.
Sure.
Your village would go, and was that an example, or was that really, you worshipped a tree there?
By the time I was born, the settlers or the colonial settlers had already come in. So it was a different story. So what I saw, for instance, was a mixture of both. Because the missionaries had already made their inroads into the villages and into the different places
Christian
around
missionaries.
The country. Yeah. So we were introduced to a blend of the two. So what I actually witnessed myself was like a departure of the real hardcore traditional African religion, and it had been fused together with what now was appeared to be a modern sort of religion.
When you say it was fused together, does that mean that there were those who were still pagan idolaters and those who were Christians, or it was a mixture of Christianity and paganism?
It was a mixture of that.
How do you mix those two?
I'll tell you what. I mean, there is the traditional African in some of the cultures there. You'll find that there is a huge emphasis on witchcraftism.
Witchcraft?
Yeah. Mm. So you could get people who are they're both like in that whole thing of witchcraftism, and at the same time they are into the new religion that was brought, and that's Christianity. So they fuse that together, and I mean that's how they conduct life. So
and when you say witchcraft, this is not a negative perception of witchcraft. This is actual how to, like, this was part of their worship was witchcraft. Can you give an example
it's
of that?
It's part of, look, they believe in the power of, like, harnessing, for instance, if someone wronged you, you can actually use nature itself to eliminate the person.
Like voodoo?
Yeah. There's so much into that. Or just using, like, the power of thunder and stuff. I don't know how they do it. I've never seen it, but it was widely known. Or they believe in maybe keeping snakes, and the snakes now are like a charm to bring about wealth. You know, these are very common things. Or if there is like a case of polygamy was very common. So if different homesteads, for instance, the mother, the stepmother doesn't like a son who appears to be really doing well, I mean, they can easily use whatever magic they have to kill the child. So the child will not be successful.
Wow,
the child of the other wife, the co-wife, will not be successful.
So this is where you came from, but by the time you came into the world, there was already a good amount of Christianity mixed into this too.
So by the time I was coming through, Christianity was very much, of course, in the city or in Nairobi, which was very young. I was born in 1981, just around 18 years after independence. So, and in the villages, the missionaries were trying to make their way. So there was still a lot of that. And at the same time, there was also Christianity trying to make inroads. So I saw that mixture, the mixture of both worlds, both the black, so to speak, and now what the missionaries had brought. And it was very easy for them to make it through because they came with like different tablets, like to heal different diseases or, you know, some modern things which...
Medicines.
Yeah.
Just, was that viewed as witchcraft the beginning?
I think it was viewed like a different sort of witchcraftism, which is on a higher level. Why? Because it was brought by, unfortunately, by someone who appeared to be of a superior nature. That's how they viewed these people, because any person who came through had a different, first of all, color of the skin. The skin color was different. And they presented themselves to be much more powerful. They had some things which they would use to kill animals which were destructive. I'm talking about firearms.
Firearms.
I mean, the locals didn't have firearms. They were used to bows and arrows.
So these people came in with all these, and I think there's some sort of a parallel between, you know, medicine, antibiotics, and witchcraft, in the sense that witchcraft is a manipulation of the spiritual world to achieve your ends, and this is a manipulation of the physical world to, in not a negative way, in a positive, like any manipulation can be used both positively and negatively.
Okay,
so these missionaries came in with all this power, and how was it well received? Was there resistance to it?
In some places, but in some, no, because first of all, as I said earlier on, we all have, like, I think any human being, there is a spiritual part, so there is always a bit of a human being that keeps on searching for that spirituality to be fulfilled. So, in as much as the missionaries and the colonialists came up with all these things, there was the rush for resources. We had missionaries who also came through, and they were trying to spread now what they call the good news.
Yeah, the gospel.
Yeah, the gospel. So they could say that, you know, for you maybe to achieve this or for you to live a happy life, or there is a life after death, if you want to go to this place, this is how you ought to worship. And
were they kind and sweet?
They were kind and sweet. The missionaries, that is, but of course the guys who came through before were not kind and sweet.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, they were quite rough.
Looking back, was this a positive infusion? Was this a step in the right direction for who were previously pagans? How do you view that now from where you're...
Well look, later on, I mean, then I didn't see it. Right now, if you're going to ask me, like, right now, I mean, I view it in the words of the Rambam.
Right, you know, just, but still in a positive direction, meaning... Yeah. Okay, anyways, I'm going to let you take over your story a little bit, and so you go ahead.
Yeah, so yeah, they came through, and people saw, well, this should be the right way, I think, that they thought that they should just follow what the missionaries were saying, and that's how now Christianity came by. So I grew up around that setting, where we were exposed to Christianity as a way to go. There was Catholicism a lot there, and then there was what we used to call the Protestants. Now we call it evangelical movement. But then it was, we were like...
Protestants.
Protestants, yeah. So, I was fast, I became like, they used to call them the altar boys, the Catholic Church. So, yeah, I was there.
Oh, interesting. So, initially they were Catholic missionaries.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We had both.
And you were an altar boy.
Very much, yeah. So I was there first, you know, went through those classes. And you know, with time, I think when I was around 12, I had someone talk about the fact that, you know, Catholicism is like idolatry. You know, they worship the mother of Jesus and everything. So, I mean, I jumped ship. At the age of around 12.
And who would go to Lugari in Nairobi and start saying that Catholicism is idolatry? Who was this person?
Yeah, just some of these pastors who used to go around, you know, they used to go around.
Oh, I see. Protestant missionaries are sort of moving from Catholicism towards evangelical Protestantism. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
I love the journey. I just love it. Go ahead.
Then it was a matter of time. I went to high school. After that, high school was like, it was basically, again, far from the village. It was just in the countryside, a place called Kitale. It's a very beautiful place. It's not far from the Ugandan border. And next to there's a mountain there called Elgon. So I studied there, and I was in what they call the Christian Union. Now, here we have like, a bunch of young men. It was a boys' boarding school. So,
Where was it?
It was a place called Kitale.
Kitale.
Yeah, it's also...
Still in Africa.
It's just in Africa, in Kenya.
Right, okay.
Far from the city. It was a semi-modern school. At least it had electricity. I grew up not like the electricity and all that was very new to me. By the time I got
so,
to
how
high
did you
school,
charge your iPhone?
We don't have iPhones. We don't have phones. We don't have televisions and radios. We used to have like the transistor radios and stuff like that. We didn't have running water in the village. Our houses were made differently. It was a mixture of like cow dung and all that. So that's the sort of environment that we were used. You know, going without the relevant or the needed meals.
Just a question. Looking back at that now, do you see that? Was it a life of suffering and deprivation, or was there a certain joy to the simplicity of it? How do you view that now?
Well, right now it might look simple to an extent, but it's a tough life. It's a very difficult life. To be honest, it's very easy for one to fall into the pitfalls of life when you're going through, when you have such a life. You know, I would never advocate for such. You know, if one is able to get out of that, the better. But at times, you know, life is just life. That's the way. You never know how life can turn out to be.
Did you know at the time that there was something greater and beyond that?
Or? I felt something that I just felt deep down inside. There is something better.
Okay, so there you are in Kitale in this.
So Kitale, I was in this school, in this high school. So I'm deeply into the Christian Union. I was like a youth leader there. The Old and the New Testament. They used to quote scriptures a lot, you know, they used to call it the morning prayers, and you pray for so many things and all that, you know, spend like 1 hour in the morning just praying and in the evening. I left. During this time, I was also very active in sports. I excelled in sports, martial artist, still do martial arts right now. It's my passion. So I went from there to the University of Nairobi. I qualified to go there where I was called to do a first degree in communication and sociology.
So you're doing communication sociology in the university while doing martial arts, which you got the scholarship for?
No. I didn't get a scholarship for the martial arts.
Okay.
It's just,
but that's, you were also doing that there?
I was just doing it.
And excelling
at it. I was doing well in that. So at the University of Nairobi, things went on well. Still, my folks were suffering back in the village, and it was very difficult, like, to secure anything when you're still studying. I managed to complete the degree, but I didn't have money, so the university couldn't let me graduate. So I missed out on 4 graduation ceremonies.
Wow. You already had all the credits, everything you need. Didn't have the money to pay for the degree.
Yeah, I had excelled very well, but I didn't have money to pay for the degree. My parents didn't have anything. They had a farm that they had inherited, just a small piece of land. By any standards, even Kenyan standards or the village standards, it was small. And they put it out on sale just to see to it that I graduate, but no buyer came through. Now,
wow, they were willing to sell the one possession they had in the world.
Yeah. They were willing to do that.
And just want to understand, the degree is so important because with that you would be able to secure a job.
At least with a degree, I mean, it's actually a new way of me like making it or trying just to make secure a living.
Right. Okay.
I tried securing a job, but it was very difficult. I used to do some part-time or some research when I was studying, and I could get like in a week, if I'm lucky, I could get like maybe 100 shillings. Now, 100 shillings is like equivalent right now to a dollar.
Wow.
Okay. $1 a week. So that, I mean, it probably just help you to buy maybe 2-3 breakfasts. It won't help you like in getting even like fare to travel from one place to another. So I had to walk. Most of the time I was walking, and that's how it was. So it came to after that I missed 4 graduation ceremonies that I had mentioned, and it got to a point where there was actually one graduation ceremony remaining because the university had a policy. If I would have failed to graduate in that last ceremony, I mean, it would have rendered my whole academic quest useless.
It expires, everything you did. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So there you were with this dilemma. Yeah.
So I was there, and right at the nick of time, someone showed up and they wanted to buy the land. It was bought, and I managed to put in some additional small monies from different people that I knew. And I took the money to the university, and that made it possible for me to graduate in 2006. 4th of December. It was on a Friday, I remember.
That sounds like a big day.
Yeah.
One of those days that stick out in your mind looking back. Okay, so you graduated.
So I graduated, and 5 months later, there's a company that I did some stuff for, and they came through, and they offered me a job just to be like head of the region. It was a huge title, but very little money. But it was fine because it was a stepping stone for me. It opened doors for me. So around that time, that's when I got the chance even to leave Kenya for the first time. And I flew over to South Africa, where I was doing some work for them. I did that for quite some time. I used to be the head of the region, basically Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania. I did that for a while. And at the same time, again, I was busy investing in my passion. You know, that's the arts. I hosted someone in my small apartment. I was living in Nairobi then. And this person now told me about Krav Maga, and they introduced me to someone in Haifa. So this person invited me, and in 2009, I flew to Israel for the first time.
Right, in the context of Krav Maga.
Yeah, Krav Maga was what brought me to Israel in the first instance. So I landed.
So for those of you out there who don't know what Krav Maga is, it's invented by an Israeli. It's the type of combat that the Israeli army uses, close contact. We don't need to get into Krav Maga. I want to stay on your journey. But okay, so you ended up here in Haifa.
Ended up in Haifa. I was. I remember getting here. I didn't have enough money, or basically lots of money. So I told the instructor, great man. His name is Dori Namitsky. He's a great man. I remember telling him for the first time. He was meeting me for the first time, and I told him, look, I don't have a lot of time. At the same time, I don't have a lot of resources. I'm just here to train. And then I get back to Kenya. The broad idea was maybe we will start an institute there in Africa, Krav Maga Institute in Africa or in Kenya or whatever, or I'll go train people there at some point, you know. So later on he told me that he was a bit, you know, he was taken aback by my statement because I told him, look, I just need a place where I can place my head. I just need a roof over my head. I don't need any fancy hotels. I don't have money for that. He got back to me and he told me, look, there is a place in the dojo, in the hall. There's like a couch there. I'm embarrassed to ask you if you wanna be sleeping there, if it's fine with you. And I told him, look, it's fine. I mean, it's fine. Cause I mean, he had no idea, but I'd seen like worse, you know.
Yeah, much worse.
For me,
I'm sure.
Was like such a luxury. So I'm like, hey, it's fine. So I used to sleep there. I used to sleep in the couch. I could wake up very early before anyone came to the dojo, clean it up and make sure that by the time guys are coming in, I mean, we start training. So I used to do that 2 weeks, I fly back to Kenya. And I keep on, I was working of course for the South Africans.
Really? So it was just 2 weeks you were in Haifa? It was
2 weeks, then fly back.
Okay.
Start saving for my next trip to Israel to train. When I feel that I've gathered enough money, I'll take some time off again and fly back, train. I did that for around five times between 2009 and 2000 and towards the 2000 and end of 2010. Flew back to and fro five times, just coming, training, and going back. On that first trip, when I was training, I met some religious Jews. And then I was like a Christian and everything, and I got into discussions, and I bring up all this stuff, and they told me, hey, by the way, you know, here, whatever you're saying is really irrelevant. I'm like, what do you mean? I mean, this is what we read. You guys don't read. You guys don't read the Bible. Like, hey, whatever you read is not what we read, and we don't believe what you believe. So now that was a statement that really changed everything. It changed everything because I was like, I mean, how come? How come? You know, we read about Israel. In what I've grown up knowing. So how come you guys don't believe this? I mean, whoever we believe is the person, he used to live here. So what's happening? You guys are the lost ones then. I went back, that was the first trip. I went back to Kenya and I asked the pastors, you know, hey, what's happening here? From Israel, which is supposed to be the center of everything. And this is what I was told. So I remember their response was, they've been blinded
right.
for our sake. So I found that answer very interesting.
Did that satisfy you?
Nah. When I came back, used to train. I used to spend time with the same religious guys who had that tea.
It's interesting that didn't satisfy you to me, because that also, I don't like that argument going in either direction. Meaning for me, I want to focus on where I'm blinded. I want to know where I'm off, because we're all off in some way. We're all trying to grow more. But if you're so confirmed and convicted and where the other guy doesn't see, you're depriving yourself of the greatest joy in life, which is the spiritual journey towards truth and focusing on your own impediments. So right. It sounds like that was already the type of journey you're on. That answer just didn't do it for you.
Yeah, it did not. It really did not convince me at all. I had some questions that were lingering that didn't leave me at all. But, I mean, nobody could answer those questions. Nobody could. So even the trips that I could make back here, including even the first time I really experienced a Shabbos, was in the house, was somewhere in the house in Bat Galim, in Haifa, at one of my friend's homes. So I remember he invited me. I took a cab, of course, knew nothing about
Shabbat and everything. Nothing,
you know. I show up and it was such a sight when I got there, the mother of the home, the father, and this friend of mine, Yudi, they're all waiting for me outside the house. They were like, hey, where have you been? When I got into the house, they handed me a kippah. So I'm looking at the kippah, and this guy grabs the kippah and puts it on my head, and they start singing, Shalom Aleichem. You know, so I'm like, wow, okay, what's really happening here? And, I mean, they do everything, the challah and everything. And I'm like, wow, I'm busy still staring. I'm confused. I remember the mother holding my hands and
washing your dime and everything.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm like, wow, okay. What's happening here? UD was busy laughing because, I mean...
Going through this.
I'm just...
When you're saying what's happening, were you saying that in a way of like... connecting? Did you feel it was beautiful? Were you enjoying it?
It was beautiful. I wanted to know more about what the whole thing entailed. I found it to be extremely beautiful, you know.
I always want non-Jews from around the world to come and experience Shabbat. Again, not to convert them. I have zero desire to convert anyone. Just to share the beauty of what like an authentic Torah Shabbat is, because so many people, most people I think that I've met on this journey are not satisfied with the answer, they are blinded. Most people want to learn and connect and to grow, and a Shabbat experience is just a great way to start that.
Absolutely. You know, see, for me, even that whole thing of just like, you know, the washing of hands and the songs, those are things when I left and I went back home on that particular trip, they were still on my mind. They were weighing on my mind so heavily. You know, I kept on remembering that, you know. I'm like, you know, when I come back, I think I want to experience that. You know, the trip after, I remember I came to, for the first time, I took some time off. And I came to Jerusalem. And this was also very special. I was looking for the Kotel. I remember I asked people, I'm looking for the Wailing Wall. They told me where it was. So I went there. I placed a note also there. And I prayed. Because it was also a very tricky moment in my life. You know, it's like I'm in the middle of decisions. I'm in the middle of thinking so much. There's a lot of confusion too. Because answers are not answered. I have all these things. I've grown up differently. And I'm facing all these, you know, so many weighty matters that are stirring inside my heart. Kotel was such an experience to me. It spoke to me. And when I was going there and I was writing the stuff that I was writing in, when I put it into the wall like everyone was doing, I quoted 1 Kings, I remember, when Shlomo should be second.
Chapter 8?
Yeah.
Right, where he talks about the nations coming and everyone, God hearing everyone's voice. Yes.
Exactly. So I remember quoting that. I quoted that and I prayed, please, you know, I'm coming from a far off nation. I literally quoted that. And I was like, please hear me out. Hear me out. Anyway, so I left, tried to cut the long story short. In 2010, I was in Kenya, flipping through the newspaper, and I saw the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Israel. They were giving two scholarships to students from Africa. And I remember I looked at it, and I called my friends, and I told them, hey, you guys, there is an opportunity to go to Israel here, but chances appear to be so slim. But let's try. Let's just try. You know, bear in mind the Israeli embassy in Kenya serves 6 countries within the region. So we knew that, I mean, chances of us, anyone even within our group, getting that scholarship were quite remote. So I applied. And the rest of my friends applied. We were all dropping our applications. So 2011, early around April, I got a call from the Israeli embassy, and I was a beneficiary of one of the scholarships.
Wow.
Yeah. So in October the same year, I flew back to Israel. It's a place that I knew. The government had given me a full scholarship that covered tuition, and they were giving me like money like for my monthly upkeep. So I came back. So I was coming back with all the questions that, you know, from last time. And it was a time now for me to, like, really immerse myself and study at the same time. But at the same time, I knew there is something, some unfulfilled business. And that's now when I got to know some rabbis. And I got to get some of the questions answered. That year went by so fast. At the end of 1 year, I was done. I flew back. Flew back to Kenya, so I got there, and I remember I was like, "Wow, you know, I have to do something about what I feel, because I'm not just gonna be living this way. I won't just continue living my life like not knowing where I'm going. You know, it's like you can't go to a church." At the same time, the local shul there, the synagogue, it's 100 years old in Kenya. It's the only one. They were a bit hesitant to have me there. They didn't know. I mean, they were like, here we take in people who are already like Jewish. I mean, what's the issue? Where are you coming from? So they were a bit hesitant to have me. So I was like, I was left in between. I was in between two worlds. Very difficult place to be at. But I was in touch with a certain rabbi that I had met while I was here. And that's when I told him, look, I simply have to convert. I have to worship Hashem, because after the research that I've done, the books that I've read, this is my path. I'm stirred up and disturbed. You know, my path like was pointing towards Israel. Everything pointed towards Israel.
But not just, before, not just pointing towards Israel, towards Judaism, to being a Jew.
Absolutely. Even before, I remember, before even I ever flew to Israel, I was once walking in the streets of Nairobi, and I saw a shop that had like so many flags, these small table flags. I saw the flag of Israel. I remember buying that flag. It was always on my table. This was way before even this whole issue of Krav Maga and everything came into play. It was way before. I had it always. In hindsight, when I looked back, it's like everything was pointing towards Israel and Judaism. So when the rabbi arranged everything and they asked me to apply to the Machon Meir, and I got in touch with the rabbis, and that's when the whole process started. They accepted me. So I stopped everything that I was doing, because then I was already working all over in Africa and also all over the world.
When you say working, in what capacity? In Krav Maga?
I was working in the field of security.
Oh, security.
It's the field of security, yeah.
Okay.
For a number of huge establishments right there in Africa.
When you say security, I don't want to get lost on this because we're already over time a little bit. You're talking about training?
No, I wasn't training. I was
actually doing security.
I was doing security.
Okay.
Yeah, investigations, executive protection, and the works. I came back. I flew back now to start the process. So I studied, and I managed to convert just 2 months ago now. 2 months.
Wow,
two months ago.
Brand new. Was that a difficult, arduous, painful process? What was that process of conversion like? Was it hard?
It's not an easy process. Fast.
I've always sort of been jealous. I always wanted to sort of go through it, you know, because it seems like there's such a context and there's such a curriculum that you have to learn. I would just feel like I would learn so much from it. I was once at a conversion of a friend, and the rabbis that were there asked him questions.
Right.
And I realized that if getting those answers right would be the key to conversion, I wouldn't be able to be a Jew. I'm a rabbi. I didn't know a lot of the answers of those questions. And I realized that they're actually asking you questions that they know you're not going to know, to show, like, the journey has begun.
Right. It's true. You know, look, what I say is, you know, we, for instance, you know, putting on the tzitzit, you know, you might have, what happens if you don't have a four-cornered garment? You know, if you just have whatever, a t-shirt, you don't have a four-cornered garment, you know, so you have a choice. It's not that you'll be in trouble for that. You know, it's a mitzvah. It's something good.
Actually in this week's Torah portion.
Yeah. But it's not, you know, it's not like, it's not that you're going to get punished for that or whatever. That's how I understood it. So that's the position that I was in. You know, when I was like in between,
mm-hmm.
I could have chosen to be Abnei Noah. You know, not everyone,
right,
of course.
A Noahite, Jew, but you accept the Torah as true and you keep the seven laws of Noah. For people who don't, who believe the Torah is true and Judaism is true, but don't want to be Jews and don't feel that compulsion, that's sort of where they land.
Exactly.
You know, and that's great for them because that's who they are. That's, you know, we each have to just become our greatest selves, and that could end up in a lot of different ways. Yeah. So
when I was there, I looked at that particular point as a blessing, so to speak, because I had a choice like any other person, like to put on that tzitzit, to put on that mitzvah, an extra mitzvah. You know, and to become a Jew, it's not easy. It's very difficult, but it's something that spoke to me, and I felt like I'm gonna dedicate my life just to live this way.
And how have the last 2 months been?
It's beautiful. I must say that it's something that I think I was well prepared for. I was looking forward to it. Of course, it's never easy waking up and all that, but the thing is, how do you feel deep down inside? You know, my body is like just a regular body, you know, your body is tired and all that. But when you fulfill this mitzvot and, you know, you feel you're really close to Hashem, I mean, I look back and I'm like, you know, I mean, I thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for all this. Now it's great. It's great. I'm living the life. You know, it's a beautiful thing. Living as per the Torah, and you know, feeling that you're really fighting to get close to Hashem. You know, reminds me of my favorite person, the Tanakh. You know, David the Melech, the way he was. You could see, you know, he's fighting to get really close to Hashem. He's fighting to really, like,
some anafshi la'elokim. My soul is thirsty for
yeah,
God. Like,
yeah. So, you know, you feel like a warrior. That's how I feel. You know, that's how I feel. It's been a long journey. You know, times you feel like, wow. But it's a journey that, if you look back, Hashem provided. Where you lacked, you never slept hungry, you know, you had what you needed. I had what I needed, you know, I was taking care of people back home. Somehow, Hashem provided. And for me, that was a real confirmation that, yeah, he was literally watching over me.
How did your parents feel about this?
Like any parent, first of all, you know, your child is going away from home. You know, they were uncomfortable with that. I remember going back when I was still in the process. I had my kippah and a hat and everything. And I just had to explain to them. I had to break it down to them, of course, you know, very calm and gentle. Yeah, so that, because, I mean, I also have to be mindful of them. Well, they took it in, but I know there's a bit in them that's also not very pleased, but... I guess some things that, you know, we have to deal with when you're making that change or that decision.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. I have many more questions I'd like to ask you. We are running out of time. We're pushing it a little bit much. Mm-hmm. Tell us what you're doing now here in Israel. You're studying at the yeshiva. You've become a Jew 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. And you're still martial arts?
Yeah, that's part of my still... passion. But before I left Africa, I'd already registered my own establishment, my own company. So after the process, after the GIU process, I knew that I think I want to strengthen that company. So just 3 weeks ago, I flew to the US and I met some top clients that I used to know. And I told them that whenever they are flying there, you know, it's a company that deals with different things from corporate intelligence to executive protection to investigations and fraud and all that. So I went there to just like market it and make sure that they are aware that that's happening. So that's something that I'm trying to do while I'm here. I'm just trying to strengthen my the company that I started. Of course, I intend to operate from here. I intend to build it. I intend to see that it can spread like all over, not just in Kenya, but even here. So that's what I'm doing on the financial side of things. And on the other spiritual side of things, I'm studying Gemara every
Talmud,
morning.
Right?
I'm studying the Talmud right now.
Not an easy undertaking.
Not easy at all.
Something I've never flourished at.
Yeah, it's not easy at all, but it's awesome. It's great. It's great. You got some incredible rabbis. Yeah, the Machon Meir.
You definitely fell upon one of the most premier Torah institutions.
Absolutely.
Where it's like, really, it's not just Torah. It's the Torah of Israel.
Oh, yeah.
It's a different Torah than the Torah of the exile altogether.
Yeah, absolutely. You got some great rabbanim here, the people who literally... you know, live the Torah. You know, they really inspire. Even when I was going through that process, you can really feel the inspiration. And they're great. They're really, really great.
So we're here. Ben Sion Mandela, you did not disappoint. Thank you so much for bringing us on the journey, and which is still underway.
For
you know, that's probably just chapter one.
Absolutely.
And we got a lot ahead. And I look forward to hearing about it. And please God, to a friendship, a lifelong friendship. I sometimes meet people and I'm like, this is a guy I want in my life. I want this guy as a friend. It just inspires me. So
thank you
to everybody out there. If you want to reach out to Ben Sion, I don't want to throw his email out there. You send me an email to ari@thelandofisrael.com. I'll forward it off to him, unless you want to put yours out there.
No.
Okay, yeah. So ari@thelandofisrael.com. You can send him messages that way. You could also reach out to me personally, to Jeremy at jeremy@thelandofisrael. And I'm going on a speaking tour. We have a few last openings on the West Coast. So if you're somewhere along there, let me know. I could maybe come out and visit your community or parlor meeting or whatever it is. If you want to support our network, what we're doing, go to thelandofisrael.com. Donate button is right there. And stay strong, stay connected, and come out to Israel. Experience the beauty of what this place is. Shalom from Jerusalem.
Founded in 1902, World Mizrahi is a global, Torah-driven, community-focused educational organization committed to Jewish identity and destiny. The Land of Israel Network is powered by the Mizrahi World Movement.
Have you ever planted a grapevine? What if the grapevine happened to be in the Land of Israel? Not only that, but if you were a Christian planting this grapevine in the mountains of Israel, you would be fulfilling prophecy that Isaiah and Jeremiah foretold more than 3,000 years ago. I'm Joshua Waller with Hayuvel, and I invite you to fulfill prophecy on the mountains of Israel by joining us this harvest. Go to Hayuvel.com, that's HAYOVEL.com for more information.